going to be teaching the first half of Beyond the Standard Model class. The second part of the instruction will be done by Junwu Huang, who is sitting back there. In this class, we'll try to give you a taste, because we won't be able to go into much detail of how things work out and the formalism of many things. But we will try to give you a taste of the need to go beyond the standard model. Why do we do it? And in order to do that, we won't just talk about what is fashionable today. We'll talk a bit about the history of how the field of beyond the standard model physics emerged and what it is trying to explain. Now, and in order to do that, we need to start from the particles of the standard model, okay? So we know there is the quarks. So we know there are three gauge groups, the color, the SU3 color, SU2 left, and U1 hypercharge. Now, there's the left-handed quarks that transform under a 3 of color, 2 of SU2, and have a hypercharge of a 6. There is U right, which has, it's again, a 3 of SU3, singlet under SU2, has a charge 2/3. We have D right, 3, 1/3, and there are 3 of these guys. Okay? Now, this is the particles that are charged under color. We also have leptons, okay? And for leptons, we have the left-handed lepton that discharges an SU2 doublet. It doesn't have a color charge, and it has a hypercharge of -1/2. And there is a right, which has, it's a singlet under everything, and it only has a hypercharge of -1/2. And again, we have -1, and we have 3 of these guys. To this, and these are the fermions of the standard model, okay? To this, we have to add the Higgs, which is singlet under color. It has SU2 charge and hypercharge 1/2, okay? On top of this, we have particles associated with the mediators of the force. So this is what we call the matter content of the standard model. And so we have the SU3 color, again, SU2 left, U1 hypercharge. So we have a gauge coupling associated with each one. And we have the mediators of the force. We have the gluons, which transform and as an adjoint of SU3. We have the W and the Z, which are another adjoint of SU2. The gluons and the mediators of the SU2 are an adjoint under SU2, and there is one guy associated with hypercharge. Usually it goes by B, has the name B boson, and then here we have, how do we call the SU2 left? Usually we generators, W? Yeah, we use the W. So then these two combined, they give the W and the Z, the masses W and the Z boson that we measure at low energies, right? Because this symmetry is broken, okay? Yeah?
Why the hypercharge?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. No, sorry. No, it's a singlet. Yeah, sorry, yes. Oh my God, why am I writing today? Okay, sorry, thank you. Thank you for catching that. Okay. So, yeah. This is all we know about the world, okay? And the great thing about the standard model is that we've tested it in experiment, and we have found that experiment and theory agree to 12 decimals, okay? So this is an extremely successful theory. Now, let's talk about what we, and so we like it a lot. And I should say here, we should add, usually in particle physics, we forget that there is also gravity, right? Which we also consider part of the standard model now, or GR. And now the question is, okay, we haven't found anything beyond this, right? So the question is, what do we need to modify? What don't we like about it? So let's start writing down things that we don't like about it, okay? As I said, if you look at the matter content, you will see you have three of each. So if you write down the quark masses, so these are the three families, and the particles of each family have different masses. So for the quarks, we have the up-type quarks and we have the down-type quarks, right? So for these guys, for the up-type quarks, we have m up roughly 2 MeV, m charm 1. Let's call it 3 GeV, and we have m top at roughly 173 GeV. Okay. Now for the down type quarks, we have, this is roughly 4.8 MeV. We have M strange, which is 96 MeV. And we have the bottom quark, which is roughly 4.2 GeV. Okay? And this is where the first evidence of ugliness comes in. Why are these so different? Where does this structure arise from? On top of these masses, you should add that there is, we have plus 3 mixing angles between the quarks, if you remember from your standard model class, and plus 1 CP violating phase. Okay? We don't know where these parameters come from. This is known as the flavor problem of the standard model, and people over the years have tried to come up with ways to explain it. Now, if you write down the leptons, similar problems arise. So you have the electron mass, which is 511 keV. You have the muon, 105 MeV, and you have the tau, 1.8 GeV, and to this I should add plus the neutrino masses, which some people don't count as part of the standard model, which are much less than the mass of the electron, okay? And there is even more parameters here. So this makes the flavor puzzle even worse. An interesting thing to remember is that some of these parameters are vital to explain how the world is. So the mass of the electron determines the Bohr radius, the size of atoms, depends on the mass of the electron. So understanding these values perhaps can tell you something about how the world looks the way it does. Other parameters. There is a term in the standard model Lagrangian. I don't know if you wrote it in the previous weeks. You can add a term that looks like there is theta QCD times g3 squared, 32 pi squared, the gluon field, GG dual. Basically, these are gluon fields contracted with the epsilon tensor. Okay? So this is a term that essentially mixes the electric and magnetic field of the strong interactions, so it violates CP. So this is a CP violating phase that, given because CP is broken in the CKM matrix, we can just write it down. And we'll come back to this later on. Now, there are other parameters. So this is one parameter, the strong CP angle. There is the Planck mass, which is 1.22 10 to the 19 GeV. That's another parameter of the standard model. There is the cosmological constant, okay, which is 2.8 times 10 to the minus 122 M Planck to the fourth. And on top of everything, front, there is the Higgs VeV, which is 245 GeV, and the mass of the Higgs, which is 125 GeV. So now, based on these values, we can start understanding why the field of beyond the standard model physics was created. First of all, even though we understand very well how matter fields interact with one another, we know that if you look at the energy budget of the universe, they only represent 5% of that. We know there is dark matter, which is about 28% of the universe. And that is a form of matter. We know that it behaves like ordinary matter under gravity, but it doesn't interact strongly with light. That's why we call it dark. Another thing for the energy budget of the universe is this number here, the cosmological constant. Some people call it dark energy. And it's, in fact, most of the energy density of the universe. It is what's causing the expansion of the universe today. And in fact, this poses one of the biggest puzzles in physics. In the standard model, the prediction for this number is at least 60 orders of magnitude larger than this. So the prediction of the standard model, if you calculate what possible contributions, radiative corrections, quantum corrections we have to the cosmological constant, would predict that the universe is at least a millimeter big, at most a millimeter big. Okay? So one of the biggest puzzles that we have today is, why is the universe so large? Now, there is another thing. So when you look at this and you do the math, probably you did it, there is always a particle and an antiparticle. But if you look again at the universe today, there is only one type of thing. We have a baryon-antibaryon asymmetry that has a level of 10 to the minus 10 relative to photons. So we have more matter than antimatter. This is what is known as the problem of baryogenesis. And this is another thing that we will need physics, cosmology would need physics beyond this to explain it. Now, the other puzzles come again because of this ugly structure. So the flavor problem, I've already told you about. So a lot of effort goes and has gone over the last 30 years trying to explain this structure. It's not pretty by any means. So whatever parameter you could write down in Lagrangian is already there. And we don't know where it's coming from. Another thing is this phase right here, and actually Junwu is something that he will explain much, much more in his class. So if you look at the CP violating phase that comes from the CKM asterisk, that's order one, and you measure it in the KK bar mixing system. Now, this parameter here, people have measured, or have tried to measure, and the only thing they've managed to do is constrain it to be less than one part in 10 to the 10. Okay, so tiny, tiny number. So this is what is known as the strong CP problem, and it's still another puzzle of small numbers. So similar to the cosmological constant problem. Another puzzle of small numbers, and in fact, the one that has attracted the most attention in the last 40 years, is the hierarchy between these two, the Higgs mass and the Planck mass. So this is known as the hierarchy problem. But there is an even simpler way to understand this. People talk about it, in fact, as, oh, the Higgs is a scalar. It's not protected by any symmetries. So you naturally expect its mass to be at the Planck scale. What would that mean? It would mean that all particles would be heavy if at the Planck mass. In that case, it would mean that the force of gravity would be the same strength as everything else. Okay, but in reality, gravity is much weaker. Now, we don't sense it, but every time we lift an object, right, you raise your arms, the electromagnetic forces in your arm beat the pull of the entire planet. Now, we are not strong enough to jump and eject ourselves in space, but in fact, if you were to compare the force of gravity to electromagnetism in the hydrogen atom, you would find that the force of gravity is 40 orders of magnitude weaker. Okay? This is another way to express the hierarchy problem. And if you've heard about ideas about supersymmetry or composite Higgs or large extra dimensions, these are all ideas that have been proposed in the last 40 years to explain this hierarchy of masses. And we will come back to that later. And it would need, any solution to the hierarchy problem would need new degrees of freedom close to the mass of the Higgs. So if you were to build a collider, I don't know, like the LHC, that would probe that energy range, you should be able to see new particles. Now, that's why the LHC was built. So the question is, what happened? Why hasn't it seen anything? So this is another puzzle that we have today.
Professor?
Yes.
So you said like Higgs is not protected by symmetry, so like the solution would introduce symmetry to Higgs? And
yes. Yes, so in supersymmetry, actually, you just double the particle content. And we actually will talk about probably on Monday, about Monday or Tuesday, on Wednesday next week, about supersymmetry. So in supersymmetry, you just double the particle content of the standard model. So for every fermion, there is a scalar. And for every scalar, there is a fermion. So another way to express the problem with the Higgs mass is that is the issue of radiative corrections. So have you ever seen this Feynman diagram? So if this is a Higgs particle now, and I have a loop of anything, like the top or the electron of any standard model particles, this would introduce a correction that goes like the cutoff of the theory squared. And the natural, if you just have the standard model, the natural cutoff is the Planck scale. Now, what happens in SUSY, you have new particles. So the scalar particles come in, and you have diagrams. If you remember from your QFT class, these have opposite signs. So the quadratic, the divergent part cancels out, and you're left with a finite part. Okay, but that also means that the SUSY particles need to be close to the Higgs mass. Otherwise, if they are too heavy, the finite part would be too large. Does that make sense? Sort of. We'll come back to SUSY, but this is, no, that's a good question. So basically what people try to do, and there are different ways. So you either have a symmetry or strong dynamics. Another way we know how to, and we'll talk about it now. Another way to produce a small scale in the theory that we know of is dimensional transmutation, what it's called. So let's take QCD, right? So QCD becomes strong at 100 MeV. So in fact, most of the mass that we have, that we carry, doesn't come from the up type mass or the down type mass. It comes because of confinement of QCD. And this is what we'll talk about in a bit. Now, before I do that, you notice that I write everything in MeV and GeV, right? This is not kilograms for masses. So we will be working throughout this class in natural units. Do you guys know what natural units are? Okay, but let's review anyway. So H bar is equal to C is equal to 1. Okay? So now it means that if I write E is equal to H bar omega, from this it means that frequency, which is has dimensions of time to the minus 1, has units of energy. Okay? If I look at mass, okay, it goes like E over C squared. It means that mass, or whatever the dimensions of kilograms, it has units of energy. Okay? What is the mass of a proton? Does anyone remember? In kilograms?
10 to the -27?
Yeah! Yeah! Kilograms and proton. Kilograms. How much is it in GeV?
1 GeV or so.
Yeah, exactly. 938 MeV, but let's call it 1 GeV between friends. Okay. What units does length have in natural units?
Inverse mass.
Yes. So that means inverse energy, okay? So length has units of inverse energy. A good mnemonic to have is that one femtometer comes from QCD. One femtometer, which is roughly the size of the proton, is equal to 1 over 200 MeV. Okay, so you can convert length scales very quickly. What units does velocity have?
Dimensions.
Yes. What units does force have?
Negative mass is derivative of potential, right? Potential is energy, and
yeah,
it's like mass, so it's a mass squared or something.
Yeah, energy squared, yes. What units does angular momentum have?
Mass, right? It's like, no, it's m times v times r, so it has to be t has dimension what?
Angular momentum.
It's
what
dimensionless, right? Because
dimensionless. Like, remember from the atom, right? You talk about the angular momentum mods L. So the angular momentum has no dimensions. Okay? Good. So now that and you will have to, another mnemonic to know is that the size of atoms, which I use a lot, is 1 over kV. So now let's go back now a bit historically, okay? So people, this is roughly, I mean, they haven't discovered all the quarks, yet, but in the late they haven't completed the fully the story, but this is what people thought think about the standard model since basically the late 70s. Okay, so now the first thing that people thought, okay, so let's forget about flavor for a second. Let's look at the gauge groups. Okay, so the first thing that people thought about to do with the standard model is to actually try to simplify its gauge structure. Now and then they realized there are several issues with that. Okay, this is the idea behind the grand unified theories that you hear about. Now, in order to be able to unify all three groups under one, it would imply that all gauge couplings have to be the same. But as we know, in lower energies, they are not. Okay? So, the question is, how do you deal with that? And the thing to realize is that because of the standard model particle content, these guys are energy dependent. There is running of couplings. Did you guys do this in your standard model class? So, so they depend on energy and they get normalized because you have diagrams of the following form. No. Okay. You have diagrams that look like this. So if I have the three-level coupling, let's say I have an electron, for example, and a photon, you have a diagram like this. This gets renormalized at one loop through a diagram like this. Right? This is the one loop correction to the coupling of the electron, for example. So if you have the scale mu, let's call it denote the scale by mu. The gauge couplings depend on energy and they depend in a form like this. These diagrams, if you sum all of them, they give you a one at one loop for a weakly couple theory, they give you this type of equation. Okay? This constant here is what is known as the beta function of the group. A useful way to rewrite this is to define T as log mu and define a variable x, which is basically 16 pi squared over g squared, or in other words, 4 pi over alpha I. And then you get a much simpler equation, that goes like this, okay? And then you can easily solve it to find that. So the value, or what is basically the inverse of a coupling at some energy scale T, where T is the log, now defined as the log of the energy, is equal to the, let's say, the starting value, whatever energy you start to run from, and it grows linearly with T, and grows or decreases linearly with T. What it does, so it tells you that the gauge couplings vary logarithmically with energy. Okay? And how they behave depends exactly what these beta functions do. So for the standard model, if you were to plot x for the different couplings as a function of t, okay, you will have some lines basically for each coupling. So can someone tell me how, where do I start from here, roughly? What is the hierarchy of the couplings? How, let's say if I measure things at 1 TeV, which is LHC energies, which coupling would start from here, which coupling would start from here and here? Which one is the strongest in the standard model?
Strong.
Yeah. Okay, then where should it lie in this plot? No, no, no. Where? It's the inverse coupling, right? So if this is large, where should it be? So the 3 is here. Now for the other 2 is a bit trickier. So it turns out the hypercharge is the weakest one. And then you have this. Okay? And now these guys kind of run, and we'll look tomorrow, the next time, what will they actually do. And then you have, and then we'll see what happens later. What happens later depends on what these coefficients are. Okay? So let's say that you have a constant that is larger than 0. So this would mean that this value decreases with energy. So you would have something in this plot that would imply that you have a coupling that just goes like this. Okay? So this has a lambda pole, what is known as a lambda pole. So it becomes, so as this crosses 0, it means that the coupling goes to infinity. This is what is known as a lambda pole. So it has a UV lambda pole, or some people call it IR free theory. Okay? If this is the behavior. Now, this is what case one. Case two, if this is constant, is less than 0. Now it means that you have the opposite behavior, right? And this means now that you start from something very strong. So you have a lambda pole at low energies, and you become UV free. At high energies, the coupling goes to 0. So different groups of the standard model behave differently. And in fact, this IR lambda pole is what leads to confinement for QCD, as we will see. So now let's see what happens in the standard model gauge groups and what makes actually QCD so special. Why do we get confinement in the standard model? So, okay. So if you remember, have you done Lie groups at all in your QFT class? Yes, they've done it. Gang's like, yes, they've done it. So let me just raise this guy up. Raise this guy further up. And okay, you can still see it. So now let's write down what is the contributions, how these things depend on the type of matter content that you have. Okay? So if you have, so the gauge groups of the standard model are of Young-Mills groups, essentially. They're SUNs, okay? So for this type of group, there is a contribution to the beta function from both the matter fields as well as the gauge bosons, the carriers of the force. So for the carriers of the force, the beta function gets a contribution that goes like minus, and this minus is very important, 11 over 3 C2 of the adjoint, and this is known as the Casimir of the representation. Okay? And this minus is very important. For each scalar, now matter fields behave slightly differently. Scalars give a contribution to the beta function that goes like plus a third this is called the index of the representation. And for fermions, there is a 2, an additional factor of 2. Okay? Now, for an SUN group, you should know that the T of the adjoint representation is equal to N. And this is equal to the C2 as well, in numerical value. And for a fundamental and anti-fundamental, or anti-fundamental, which is, this is what the standard model particle content doesn't have any matter adjoints. It only has the force carriers are the adjoints. This is a half. Okay? Now, if you have a U1, there is no contribution to the running from the gauge force because there is just one guy. There is no interactions between the gauge bosons. And you just get a Q square contribution to the running. Depends on the charge. So here's the thing. The sign of the beta function, now you see, depends on the balance between the amount of contribution to the beta function that you get from the gauge bosons and the matter fields. So for the standard model, the matter and the for the U1 and the SU2, the matter content always gives a larger contribution than the gauge bosons. So what you find is that for SU2, or left, or U1 hypercharge is larger than zero. Okay? Now, this is where you see that color is special. So when you count all the degrees of freedom and add them up, and I think this will be an exercise, right, to calculate the beta functions, you find that beta 0,3 is less than zero. This is the reason why you get confinement at low energies. This is the reason why our mass is not determined by the up and down masses that they get from the Higgs, but it is determined by the confinement scale of QCD. And at high energies, you get a UV-free theory. This is known as asymptotic freedom. And in 2004, a Nobel Prize was given to the people that computed the beta function for SU3 back in the late 70s, early 80s. Okay? This fact is extremely important for our existence, surprisingly enough. So people have now people have a bit of intuition about what is happening, and they say, okay, how do I understand this behavior? And they say, well, if you look at quantum corrections, like virtual particles, fluctuations of the vacuum. So the reason that you get this asymptotic freedom is because when you look at charges interacting at high energies, meaning at very short distances, you have the charge gets screened because you excite a lot of the gauge bosons that also carry charge themselves. While that doesn't happen for the U1 or the SU2 left. Now, this is a bit after the fact, this intuition about virtual particles. But this sign is what changes it all. Now, let's go back to the question. So you have these three couplings in the standard model. You have hypercharge, you have the weak coupling, and you have the strong coupling. And at low energies, then you look nothing alike. So if we have any hope to have a grand unified theory, what you need to have is the following. So we have, you have 1, 2, and 3. You will have to somehow make the situation. So at some scale T naught, which is log some energy naught, these guys meet at one point. Now, the condition for that to happen, you can determine by the running equations, okay? So what you require is that the x1 at t0 is equal to x2 at t0 is equal to x3 at t0, okay? And for that to happen, you have to have special initial values and special matter content, okay? So turns out, and this is something that you will, I think, work out in your tutorial, is that the starting values of the gauge couplings, 3, 0. So the relative difference of these axes has to be equal to the ratio of the beta functions, okay? P2, the difference in the beta functions, P3 minus P2, okay? And the scale of unification is equal to x1 minus x2 b2, okay? So as you will see, what we will discuss next time is exactly under what conditions this happens. And in order for this to happen, you need to have special matter content. And you will calculate the beta functions of the standard model in your tutorial, and you will see that they kind of meet, but not really. They just miss each other. It's actually quite special to have three lines meet at a point, right? And as I will discuss, this is another reason why supersymmetry became extremely popular. Because the particles that you add with supersymmetry make sure this happens. And this is, in fact, an experimental fact. Now, for next time, what we will discuss is what actually sits here. So let's imagine that we have particle content that allows us for things to unify at a high scale. So the question is, what do we find here? And usually I should say, people leave out gravity. Gravity is another can of worms that people just push under the rug, okay? There is a nice paper by that we'll go into next time by Georgi and Glashow. A very simple, very nice paper from 1974, where they discuss that if you look at the gauge structure of the standard model, you have the 3-2-1 structure going into very nicely and into an SU5. And this SU5 unification is the first basically, it's kind of the first beyond the standard model model ever built, even though back then they didn't have the full picture, because it requires new things, new degrees of freedom to be added, and it motivated all sorts of searches. Okay, so I will stop here and take your questions so that we, yeah.
Is that model statically free, SU5?
I forget, actually. It depends on what particle contents you have here, not necessarily. So it depends on what... So when they unify here, this x is 1/25. So it's not really... No, alpha is 1/25. No, it's not... At this value here, SU5, turns out it's not strongly coupled. And what happens afterwards depends on the type of particles you add at that energy that you need to add, because if you start with this symmetry, you need to break it down to this, right? So the way you break it affects what particles, so the matter content. So it can, but it, not necessarily so. And this is what we'll go into next time, the details of that breaking and what it implies actually for the standard model, because it had huge implications. The possibility that you unify at that scale had huge implications for what things you should look for the standard model. Yeah, other questions?
How are grand unified theories looking nowadays?
Good. We'll come back to that. They look kind of okay, actually. It depends. See, this is the great thing. It depends, actually, to what you unify to. It depends a lot, turns out, on what this scale is. Because one of the generic predictions of grand unified theories is that the proton decays. So the fact that we haven't seen any proton decay places a constraint, and we will do estimates of that next time, on this scale of unification. So some theories of grand unified theories look not so great, like unification in the standard model, for example. But in theories of supersymmetry, things look A-OK still. And in fact, in the 80s, there was a huge, huge effort. People were building, historically, and I will say this again next time. People were building huge detectors, right? So how do you detect proton decay? Now, first of all, it better live for a really long time, longer than the age of the universe. Otherwise, we wouldn't be around. So in order to see very rare events, you just take a tank that has a lot of protons. Basically, you get... something that has low radioactivity, right? So some noble liquid or... And you try to see if you have decays of the protons. And we'll discuss next time how the proton can decay. And if you don't see something, you place a constraint on the lifetime. In fact, the current constraint of the proton lifetime is 10 to the 34 years, depending, and depends still on the decay mode. Now, the age of the universe is 10 to the 10 years. Okay? So we have constrained something. So the proton lives for many orders of magnitude longer than the age of the universe. And this is both a puzzle and a relief in many ways. A relief because we need to be here. But it also places a lot of tension in these theories too. Okay?
So what is meant to be like breaking scale of SU5? When?
So you'll do this in your tutorial, you'll kind of calculate it. So it's around, for the standard model, it turns out it's around 10 to the 14 GeV.
Okay.
Now, what does this tell you? Well, now for supersymmetric theories, it's different. No, this is not for, 10 to the 14 GeV is not for, it's 10 to the 16 GeV. Okay? And next time, actually, the first thing we will start is we'll lay out the presentation and everything. You'll see how the proton decays and where the scales come from. When are they doing the first tutorial?
Tomorrow morning.
Oh, okay, they're great. Then you'll do all the running and you'll get it. You'll see the scale where they kind of unify it, okay? Because the three lines will be missing each other.
But they kept in the second tutorial, they were showing you in SUSE the action.
Yeah.
Yeah, so how rigid the arguments nowadays are that like desert is real?
Well, that's a good question. So first of all, gauge coupling unification is it depends logarithmically on the energy, right? So it's very slow. That means, though, that if I change the mass of the particles by factors of 10, it's still a small change on the log. So it's a small correction of how the lines move around. So it tells you that where you have the particles, you're not super sensitive to that. Nevertheless, you will see that the supersymmetry, because it has so many particles, it makes a huge difference. The other thing is, where does it lie? We did have, and I will show plots next time, we did have evidence for gauge coupling unification. And it worked really well in supersymmetry. And this is what made people believe in supersymmetry. But again, it's a logarithmic accident, right? So you can only take it, you cannot take it as proof of anything. You can take it as indirect evidence of something. Okay? It's a beautiful structure, as you will see. The gauge. Having things like fall into multiplets makes sense. It makes everything look prettier. But automatically it introduces problems, as you will see, because of the ugliness of the standard model. If you start looking at the Higgs sector, if you start looking at the flavor sector, nothing really works with everything together. And we'll go to details next time. Yeah.
So did people really expect like low energy SUSE there, or it was just a good wish?
No.
Was there a good reason to believe there was?
There was good reason. Hold on to your horses. Friday. Friday I'll show you. I show you plots, okay? I'll show you plots on Friday, and people, they had good reason. They had good reason, and there were several things that were, and we'll go into the details of proton decay, and I will tell you there was an entire history. So at some point in the 80s, people thought they saw proton decay because they had this huge detector and they saw some events, two or three events, and were like, oh my God, and the rate of proton decay matched standard model unification, everyone's super excited. Well, turns out the events were not there. But then something interesting happened at LEP, where they kind of saw this indirectly, right? You measure the way you have a prediction for gauge coupling unification is the following. So let's say I measure couplings 1 and 2, okay? and I see where they meet. Now, given my particle content, I can predict the value of 3. I can do that. So if I go and measure the coupling 3 and see that it matches with experiment, then that's a prediction, right? And in fact, this is what happened at LEP, the collider at CERN, in the early 90s. So people didn't only be like SUSY because it was pretty. There was indirect evidence. And again, it's indirect, right? It's not, it's a logarithmic, it would be logarithmic accident. Now you extrapolate at very high energies. And as you said, is it really true to believe that there is a desert? We know we have information that there are new particles up to a TeV. But the unification scale in SUSY is 10 to the 16 GeV, which is 13 orders of magnitude. Is it reasonable to assume that there is nothing else in that range that will change this picture? And how reasonable is that?